Universal Studios Hollywood is introducing the California Neighbor Pass. For the neighborly price of just $119 online, you get over 200 days in the park. So swing by and share some laughs with your neighbors, like the Minions. Or Homer Simpson.
Donuts.
Even go on an adventure with Harry Potter.
Stay close and follow me.
Visit UniversalStudiosHollywood.com to get over 200 days of thrills, laughter, and wonder with the new California Neighbor Pass for $119 online. Pass out for 9 months from selected first visit dates. Blackout dates, restrictions apply.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn.
Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Welcome to yet another exciting show. In fact, this is my favorite kind of show. It's one that busts myths, in this case, dietary myths, and there are so many. For example, there's the myth that you should fear fat and do everything you can to avoid eating it. There's the myth that exercise is a weight loss tool. To quote from my guest tonight's book, in fact, when heavy people exercise regularly, their resting metabolism slows by 5 to 15% on average. Shocking, huh? We'll bust these myths and many more tonight thanks to my guest, dietary researcher Jeff S. Volek, Ph.D., R.D., which is why I did just call him Dr. Volek. He's co-author with Stephen D. Finney, M.D., PhD of the Art and Science of Low-Carbohydrate Living, an expert guide to making the life-saving benefits of carbohydrate restriction sustainable and enjoyable, which is like the longest subtitle ever, but it's true. I got Volek and Finney's book after Dr. Michael Eads, whom I greatly respect as a source of evidence-based dietary information, called it the best low-carb book in print, and I absolutely concur. Stay with me for this hour, and you will find out why. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So we in this country have porked out, but not for lack of trying and trying and trying to lose weight. And in all fairness, we had help porking out. Our government and far too many doctors pushed this low-fat, high-carb diet on us, which, as you write, is precisely the diet that makes fat diabetic and otherwise grossly unhealthy.
Well, that's true, and in many regards, we've done a massive experiment in this country over the last 30 to 40 years by way of really promoting in a very aggressive way the idea that people should restrict fat to lose weight and to become more healthy. And now that the results in some ways have come in, as you say, we are fatter than ever. And we have an epidemic of diabetes, and it's not just in the U.S., it's really a worldwide pandemic.
And now the results are in, but actually the truth is that the results have been in for a long time, and we had something happened, in the U.S. to sort of push us on this path, and give us a little bit of the history on this.
Well, the history is quite fascinating. As I said, it really goes back 40 years ago, and I will say people have written about this in a much more eloquent way than I could ever state. Probably Gary Taubes has the most comprehensive analysis of the many reasons that we went down this path of low-fat diets. But you know, realistically, the economic forces are a big part of it. We if you ask, what do we do really well in this country? Clearly, we grow grain, and we have this idea that if we grow it, we should eat it, and we're trying to feed a burgeoning population. And so, this coincided with recommendations that really come out of the government, specifically the United States Department of Agriculture. And so in that way, it's not surprising that they're promoting consumption of grains. And, of course, there's political forces and a number of factors, really, that have pushed us in this direction of demonizing fat. And at the time, there was a little science. Clearly now we know that science was misinterpreted, and unfortunately we haven't changed course soon enough. And that's problematic, and that's one of the reasons that I'm a researcher and that I'm promoting the research that we've done and many other good researchers and scientists have done in nutrition that really doesn't get promoted. We can seem to continue to go down this path, which has been in many ways an epic failure.
Yeah, and actually one thing that's really shocking to me, and I read about this in Gary Taub's book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, that these aides for George McGovern with no science experience got together to create the food pyramid, and lo and behold, in 2010, the government is still promoting the antithesis of what the evidence says. They're saying that, for example, that the human brain is carb-dependent. And, you know, I'm the advice goddess, and even I understand that the brain does not need carbohydrates for energy, and you write about this.
Well, it's true, and there are just blatant errors in fact in the dietary guidelines. That's just one of many. You know, the brain is a carb-dependent organ if you continue to consume carbohydrate. But clearly the brain can adapt to using ketones for fuel when carbohydrates in the diet are restricted. And these are just simple biologic facts that have been known for decades that are really completely ignored by the you know, the authors of the dietary guideline and the committees that that really you know, are in place to ensure that there is a scientific background and scientifically validated approach for these guidelines, and so it's disturbing that these types of errors in fact actually continue to get promoted.
And actually, I would say the corn lobby is immensely important, but I want to just backtrack because I want you to explain insulin is a very important element in this, in our getting fat. And I want you to explain what insulin is and how it drives fat storage and stimulates hunger.
Sure. Well, you know, there's always a danger in nutrition to oversimplify things, but clearly insulin is an important factor when it comes to metabolism and when it comes to weight loss and really health in general, because insulin is a hormone that is an important hormone. We need insulin in our body. The problem is that many people have high insulin levels because of all the carbohydrate they're consuming, in particular the processed carbohydrates and simple carbohydrates that drive up this hormone in our body. And insulin.
Let me just stop you and ask
sure.
you, what are those? Just talk about what they are so we can, you know, be sort of practical about it.
Well, carbohydrate in general is the main stimulus for insulin. But the faster a carbohydrate gets digested and absorbed into the bloodstream, the generally speaking, the higher the insulin levels. So this would be anything that gets digested quickly. So processed grains, sugar in general, table sugar, glucose. Anything with a high glycemic index.
So bread and potatoes and rice and pasta
are all generally absorbed very quickly and would stimulate insulin levels.
And then the insulin, what is when your insulin level is stimulated, what does that do to your body?
Well, many things. If you study insulin physiology, it's very complex. But the function that we're most familiar with is that insulin drives blood sugar into cells. So, for example, when you eat carbohydrate and your blood sugar increases, insulin levels go up and drive that blood sugar into muscle cells or into fat cells in order to bring the blood sugar level back down to normal. The problem is if you consume too many carbohydrates, insulin levels are constantly high. And insulin does other things. In addition to its effects on glucose metabolism, insulin also is the most important hormone controlling fat storage and fat release. So what insulin is referred to in many classes, where if you study metabolism, is the storage hormone. So insulin promotes storage of nutrients, including fat. And in fact, if you look at the evidence, insulin is very exquisitely sensitive in controlling fat breakdown. So if insulin goes up just a little bit, it puts the brakes on accessing your fat stores for fuel. So when you eat these carbohydrates, you're essentially promoting carbohydrate burning or carbohydrate oxidation and inhibiting fat burning or fat breakdown and fat burning. And this is exactly the opposite of what you want to do when you're trying to lose body fat.
Now, can you explain what is insulin resistance? Because that's a term in your book, and that's a term that people hear in the media, and I think they don't really understand what that means.
Well, I'm not sure I understand either. It's actually a very complex disease or process that happens in the body, and it varies from person to person. But I'll just express a few features of insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is the hallmark of type 2 diabetes. So when you have insulin resistance, as the name implies, the cells in the body are resistant to the effects of insulin. So if insulin normally promotes glucose uptake into cells, if you're insulin resistant, it means that there's some impairment in the ability of insulin to achieve that effect. And that's why in a type 2 diabetic who's insulin resistant, they have high blood sugar. They have plenty of insulin circulating around, but it's not working right because of some defect in the muscle cell or in other cells in the body, so that it's not doing its job in an efficient way. And this manifests in high blood sugar levels.
Now, you categorize the diseases that are characterized by insulin resistance as carbohydrate intolerance. And it turns out, you're right, that people have different tolerances. And I see that, you know, if I don't eat carbs, I haven't since March of 2009, when I actually, we were shooting my book cover of I See Root People, and I had spent my month of March with my snout and a trough of Haagen-Dazs. And they gave us 4 days to shoot it. And having read Gary's book, you know, I'm not a Hollywood starlet. I didn't have to be really skinny, but I knew how to lose weight. And so I took off. I lost, I think, like, who knows, because I know what you say about the scale, that it's not a good way to measure. But I lost probably 8 pounds, you know, in 4 days. But, and I was going to just go back to eating the way I was eating, but I felt so great. I thought, I can't do that, you know. And so, you know, whereas I'd be a little bit fatter if I ate bread, my boyfriend can't even look at a cracker, you know, gained 3 pounds. So, you know, are these differences based on what, race or country of origin where your ancestors from, or is it more random than that?
Yeah, no, there's actually a lot of important points you brought up. So, first of all, yeah, there is certainly a genetic component to insulin resistance, but I want to come back to this idea that you you mentioned about insulin resistance and carbohydrate intolerance. This is sort of a connection that Steve and I made in the book. Because if you think about insulin resistance, when you eat carbs, your blood sugar goes up. And if you're insulin resistant, that blood sugar is not being processed in a healthy way because of the dysfunction in insulin. And so that's manifesting itself as a form of carbohydrate intolerance. So insulin resistance is, in many ways, a form of carbohydrate intolerance. And I think this is a helpful way to view insulin resistance, because when you're intolerant to a nutrient, say lactose intolerant or gluten intolerant, it's pretty obvious what you do. You restrict that nutrient to a point where it doesn't cause problems. And so if you're insulin resistant, if you're carbohydrate intolerant, it's quite logical or rational to restrict carbohydrates in order to improve your metabolic state. And in that way, you know, I think people can understand it without knowing a lot of the you know, the underlying details. But clearly, as you mentioned, people vary widely in their level of insulin resistance and their level of carbohydrate tolerance. And this is probably one of the key points about diet, is that we really need to move toward personalization of diet and personalization of carbohydrate in particular. If you're carb tolerant, you have more options. You can eat moderate to high levels of carbs and process that in a very healthy way. However, if you're insulin resistant and carb intolerant, you have fewer options, so you need to probably restrict carbohydrates to some level. If you're really insulin resistant, say a type 2 diabetic who on the continuum is the most carb intolerant, you may need to restrict carbohydrates to less than 50 grams or even 40 grams per day. So it really varies from person to person, and the key is sort of finding your own personal level of carbohydrate tolerance.
You have a very interesting chapter on that called Personalized Nutrition, or maybe that's just what I titled it in my notes, but I just wanted to emphasize something that sort of flew by, but that you think that personalized nutrition will become the thing of the future, and I tend to agree. And you say in here that when you and your co-author are introduced to people as nutritionists, they'll say to you, what should I eat, or how much should I restrict my carbs, and you, what do you say to them?
Well, it depends.
Right.
And it really does, because, you know, people, it's a funny science, nutritional science, because people really demand translation of the science, and the science is very complex. But at the end of the day, people, a lot of people anyway, they don't want to understand necessarily why. They just want to know, what should I eat? And that's, you know, that's very much an art and a science, to find the right set of foods that is really compatible with a person. So I do think personalized nutrition is the future. We have a long way to go to really understand how we best personalize diet. And that's one area that I'm particularly interested in from a scientific perspective, is developing diagnostic tools so that we can objectively measure markers in people to let them know if they're on the right path, you know, to actually give them sort of their own personalized GPS to know if they're consuming too many carbohydrates or if they're doing fine and processing them in a healthy way. But right now, that science is very much in its infancy.
Yeah, you're right that there's a real dearth there. And what I wanted to ask for people listening is, what are ways that a person can determine their level of carb intolerance?
Well, you know, if you have metabolic syndrome.
But let's take us back. And what is metabolic syndrome?
Yeah, metabolic syndrome is a growing problem around the world. It's basically a form of prediabetes, so it is associated with insulin resistance, but it's not quite, you know, the full-blown type 2 diabetes yet. But it's a complex syndrome that's characterized by different biomarkers. The most common ones that are used are high blood levels of triglycerides or low levels of the good or cardioprotective HDL cholesterol. It's also characterized by high blood sugar and blood insulin levels. High blood pressure is one of the features, and increased adiposity or body fat, in particular increased body fat that's carried in the abdominal area.
I'm looking at this, and you say 40 inches, greater than 40 inches for men, or greater than 35 inches for women. So if your waist is that big, that's one of the three things that would indicate maybe that you have metabolic syndrome.
Right.
And so
those are some objective measures, but usually if you have those, I mean, that means you've probably been over-consuming carbohydrates for some time. And if you have more than 30 pounds to lose, you're probably exhibiting some form of carbohydrate intolerance.
Well, how do people decide? You know, I decided because I've read about wheat and how damaging it is, and we sort of skipped around a little bit. Agriculture really only came in between 5 and 10,000 years ago for people on this planet, and so we evolved about 1.8 million years ago. And so, you know, chances are it seems that we're not adapted for that. But how do we each figure out you know, should you eat some carbs, no carbs? How does a person decide that?
Well, we are working on some biomarkers, so we think we're pretty close to actually finding some good markers that we can look at non-invasively to know if people are exceeding the level of their carb tolerance. But some of the classic ways that are out there are looking at these features of metabolic syndrome. So if you're over-consuming carbs, your triglycerides, the fat that's in your blood will go up. If you're consuming carbohydrates above your tolerance, you will tend to have a lot of cravings for carbohydrate, and you'll be hungry quite often during the day. I mean, that's a sign that your body's kind of in a fuel crisis, and you're not, you know, you don't have adequate fuel flow. So if you're, you know, not losing weight, or if you've hit a plateau, that could be an indication that you're, you know, over-consuming carbohydrate. So those are, you know, those are some subjective and objective markers, but it's still, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of still wiggle room, I guess, in these markers. And the markers we're looking at are much more sensitive and actually sort of tell you how your body's processing carbs. Because if you're processing them in a healthy way, they're being burned and oxidized and not contributing or being converted to fat in the body. If they're being mismanaged, the incoming carbohydrate is actually going to the liver and being converted to fat. And you don't feel that. You may notice it after several months and years that you're gaining weight and you're sort of metabolically sick. So we have some markers that tell you in a much more sensitive and rapid way if your body's converting the carbs or a greater percentage of the carbs into fat.
I want to do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Tonight's terrific brain belongs to Dr. Jeff S. Volek, PhD. He's a co-author with Stephen D. Finney, MD, PhD, of The Art and Science of Low-Carb Living, which is a terrific science-based book directing you to really let go of all the myths, but doing it with rigorous science. Dr. Michael Eads, whom I greatly respect, for his science-based dietary information. He called your book the best low-carb book in print, Dr. Volek, and I absolutely concur. So I wanted to just touch on some of the myths. You know, you talked about the one where eating carbohydrates is actually what causes fat, but not eating fat. But one of the myths that people believe is that you know, on a low-carb diet, you lose weight faster, but it's mostly water and muscle, not body fat. So tell us why that's a myth.
Well, first of all, study after study shows greater fat loss when you control the diet, you have good compliance, and you compare a low-carbohydrate, or what we like to call a well-formulated low-carb diet, to a low-fat diet, on average, fat loss is greater in subjects randomized to a low-carbohydrate diet. And we've done very careful measurements of body composition and show no greater loss of lean body mass or muscle mass. Surely, you do lose some water weight initially because there is a diuretic effect. You lose water when you restrict carbohydrates. Part of that is because of the glycogen stores in your muscles are going down. That's the storage form of carbohydrate in the body, and each gram of glycogen carries a couple grams of water with it. So you may lose a pound or so of water weight associated with glycogen, but the process of restricting carbohydrates also affects the kidneys. And so you do lose some water weight. It's not a bad thing. It's actually losing some of the excess water weight that many people carry. But that's just the first few days. Over time, body fat is the primary source of the weight loss if you're following a well-formulated low-carbohydrate diet. And we've done exercise studies while people are on low-carbohydrate diets, and it's even possible to gain lean body mass while losing body fat, for example, if you incorporate weight training with a low-carbohydrate diet.
We'll get into that a little bit later, I hope. I wanted to touch on this one, the myth that we need carbs for energy, especially while exercising. There's a guy on my site who's one of my regular commenters, and he's a workout guy. I think he might be a trainer, and he tried low-carbing, and maybe for like 2 days, and complained that he was really tired. It made him feel terrible. He had no energy.
Yeah, well, that's common, and that's been one of the reasons why low-carbohydrate diets haven't been promoted for athletes and people exercising regularly. It's actually an interesting history and evolution of dietary recommendations with sports nutrition and recommendations for athletes, because they both started in the 60s with a high carbohydrate paradigm in sports nutrition, and the carbohydrate loading regimens and so forth. A lot of that science was done 40 years ago. But the real Achilles heel of all that research is when they compared those high carbohydrate diets to low carbohydrate diets, they were only for 2 or 3 days, which didn't allow enough time for the body to adapt to a low carbohydrate diet.
How long does that take?
Well,
it's
hard to put a number on it, but generally it takes at least a couple weeks to switch over to burning primarily fat for fuel. But if you ask, you know, it probably varies a little bit from person to person, but to fully adapt may take a month or more. So clearly 2 days is not long enough, and so that explains why your friend may not have felt very well, because he was in that transitional period of switching fuel sources from being a carb burner, because he was eating more carbohydrates, to switching over to burning fat. And that's the primary metabolic adaptation when you're following a low-carb diet, is your cells switch over to burning almost exclusively fat at rest, but also during exercise. And so that's a very powerful adaptation that takes some time to really fully develop. But once you do that, you have access to a much larger fuel source by way of your fat stores.
Oh, tell us what bonking is and how carb restriction seems to be the solution for bonking. And no, that's not dirty, everybody listening out there, although I wish it were.
I know. I came to understand the alternative definition for bonking from my European friends. But we'll call it hitting the wall.
In exercise, right?
But exercise. Well, this is a well-characterized phenomenon that generally occurs, you know, if you're running a marathon, for many runners, it occurs at about 20 or 22 miles, which corresponds to the time when your body runs out of carbohydrate fuel. So we can only store a limited amount of carbohydrate in our body as glycogen, and that's about 2,000 calories worth of glycogen, mainly in our muscles and a little bit in our liver. So after a couple hours of exercise, you've depleted that glycogen, and so you don't have a source of glucose for the brain in particular. And so really what hitting the wall or bonking is, it's a fuel crisis primarily in your brain. Your brain is literally starving, and so it shuts down. And, you know, if you've ever hit the wall, it's a pretty memorable event where you have these intrusive thoughts of carbohydrates, because the brain is literally starving, and, you know, it doesn't want to support exercise. It wants to seek out food and fuel by way of glucose. So by switching over to burning fat for fuel, if you follow a low carbohydrate diet for 3 or 4 weeks, you essentially are taking the pressure off supplying carbohydrate, because the body is switching over to burning fatty acids and ketone bodies. And as we said at the beginning of the show, the brain can adapt to burning ketones. And so that's a much larger fuel source. There's even the leanest athlete has 40,000 calories worth of fat on their body that they could access.
And in fact, your co-author, Stephen Finney's, he did this study with bike racers, and apparently after, if I'm remembering it correctly, after that period of getting used to the change in diet to a low-carb diet, they had the same output on the Inuit diet, which is a very low-carb diet, as they did on the high-carb diet.
That's right. He did some real classic studies back in the early 80s looking at high-level cyclists and adapting them to a very low carbohydrate diet for 4 weeks, and showed preservation of endurance exercise performance, but very profound changes in the fuel use. So these athletes were able to do that same amount of exercise by burning almost exclusively fat. So they became really super fat burners.
Now, when I went off carbs, I had three really bitchy weeks. I felt like crap, but I knew that I was doing something right. But this was in 2009, and Gary Taubes didn't come up with something that I see in your book, too, about, oh, drink chicken, salted chicken broth while you're doing this until long afterward. And so can you talk about how your salt metabolism is different when adapted to low carb? And I guess just emphasize that people should do this so they won't feel like crap like I did.
Yeah. Yeah, no, well, this is a really important, I guess even taking a step back, it is important to, you know, sort of educate yourself on some of the parameters around formulating a low-carb diet. There are certainly a lot of people who take a more casual approach, and it works for some, but other people run into some problems. And so there are some, beyond just the carb restriction, there are some other factors that you really need to be aware of. In regards to formulating a low carbohydrate diet that's safe and effective and sustainable, so as you say, one of those is related to salt, and you know, just like fat and saturated fat, we really tend to demonize salt. And if you're following a high carb diet, it probably does make sense to limit salt. But when you restrict carbohydrates, there is a profound change in the body in how it metabolizes salt. So when you restrict carbs, your kidneys go from retaining salt on a high carb diet to excreting more salt in your urine. And when you excrete salt, you also excrete fluid with that, and that therefore you lose some of your plasma volume, some of your blood volume. And this is why many people experience fainting when they restrict carbs, or some people get headaches, or they're constipated, or they just feel tired and lethargic. Because if you reduce your plasma volume, those are all symptoms of a low plasma volume. And so this all translates into a need to replace sodium at a higher level than if you're eating a high carbohydrate diet. And it's not a huge amount, but it, on average, it ends up being about an extra gram or two per day. And we recommend that you do that by consuming broth. It's preferably homemade broth with bones and so forth, because there's a lot of valuable micronutrients. Calcium for one, magnesium and so forth in that. But if that doesn't work, the cubes also deliver a nice dose. Most of them have about 1 gram of sodium per cube of bouillon. And so that's an easy way to measure, to get a measured dose of sodium on a low-carb diet.
I want to do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Tonight's fabulous brain is Dr. Jeff S. Volek, PhD, and he is co-author of The Art and Science of Low Carbohydrate Living, which just smashes about every myth you've ever had or heard about diet. I want to get to a big one, which is we are, of course, an extremely fat-phobic and dietary fat-phobic country, but we low-carbers apparently need a lot more fat than we think we need and a lot less protein.
Right. Well, this idea that you are what you eat, that's so pervasive in nutrition, is one that really needs to be changed to something along the lines, you are what you save from what you eat. Because when you eat dietary fat, it doesn't get stored necessarily. It depends on how much carbohydrate you eat with the fat. So this is specifically very important in relation to saturated fat, because we really demonize saturated fat for being the culprit in obesity and heart disease and so forth, and this has largely been the primary basis for our dietary recommendations to restrict saturated fat.
And let me just say, just so we know this is true, the lipid hypothesis that cholesterol causes heart disease, there's so much dietary information based on that, but that's never been proved, right?
Well, we've been trying to prove it for 40 years, and there's clearly no smoking gun study that supports it. In fact, after 40 years of throwing literally billions of research dollars toward proving that hypothesis, I think we could say in 2012 that hypothesis is really on thin ice, or it's filled with holes. It's more like Swiss cheese than So clearly there's problems with the hypothesis, but it was based on a sort of syllogistic logic that if you restrict dietary saturated fat, that would reduce your cholesterol levels in your blood, which in turn would reduce your risk of heart disease. And that logic, though, A equals B and B equals C, as you said, has really never been proven. In fact, it's been disproven in many studies.
There's right now, I keep reading about these sort of suspicions that people have that maybe there's some evidence behind and inflammation may be the cause of heart disease. Where do you stand on that?
Well, clearly, having high levels of inflammatory markers, just sort of basal inflammatory markers, meaning that your body's sort of in a consistent or constant level of low-grade inflammation, is a risk factor for diabetes, heart disease, and probably cancer as well. So, I think underlying inflammation is very important, and having, for example, a high level of C-reactive protein, which is an indication that you have low-grade inflammation, is clearly a risk factor for diabetes. And this may be why statins sort of gave a little bit of strength to the diet heart hypothesis because of it has a profound effect on lowering LDL cholesterol, and there's some evidence that may in turn reduce your risk of heart disease. But we now understand that statins work through other mechanisms independent, perhaps, of the cholesterol-lowering effect, and one of those effects is they're anti-inflammatory. So lowering your LDL by a statin versus lowering your LDL by restricting dietary saturated fat are two very different things.
Yeah, a steak does not have the side effects, the horrible, horrible side effects of statins.
Right, right.
I want to ask you a question from our chat room. Jim P. Asks, something that you write about a bit in the book, is gout a possibility in a low-carb diet, and how do you avoid it?
Well, gout is a disease that is characterized, or at least it's brought on by high levels of uric acid. And this is if you measure uric acid in someone that initiates a low-carb diet, it sometimes goes up moderately. And this is mainly because when you go on a low-carb diet that's very low in carb and produce ketones, there's competition for excretion between ketones and uric acid in the kidneys. And so the ketones tend to win out, and you retain a little bit more of the uric acid. So if you do sort of serial measures of uric acid, they will gradually go up the first couple weeks of a low-carb diet. But in all the studies we've done and others as well, it comes back down after a couple weeks. And there's no evidence that minor bump in uric acid precipitates a bout of gout. Gout usually flares up when you have really wide swings in uric acid where it goes up and down quite rapidly. So even if you have gout, I don't consider that a contraindication to implementing a low-carb diet.
I'm glad to hear you say that because a friend of mine has not a low-carb dieted for a long, long time because of the gout, and I would like to see him be healthier.
Would mention that the protein in the diet can also precipitate gout, but this is a good time to inject with the idea that a well-formulated low-carb diet is not high in protein. It's not low in protein either, but it's moderate in protein. But there's this widespread misconception that these are low-carb, high-protein diets.
Well, let me ask you. You said I could ask you a few questions. I wanted to ask you, because I'm very concerned about getting enough fat, and so I'm always worried if I eat something like chicken, or the worst thing would be like if you're at a deli and they just have that packaged turkey that it seems to have no food value for me because there's no fat. So I made chicken, which my boyfriend put in my refrigerator because he's like my big Sally Struthers, leaving me food. And they had like 1 gram of fat maybe. So I cooked them in coconut milk, which has the fat, and ate the chicken with the coconut milk to add fat. I mean, is that a smart thing to do? Do you need to add fat to those foods like fish and chicken that don't really have it?
Well, you don't want to overconsume protein. So once you've met your protein requirements, you're restricting your carbohydrates, it depends on how much energy. If you really want to lose weight, then you may need to restrict the fat a little bit, because carbs are locked in at whatever level, you know, your individual tolerance dictates. Protein is kind of locked in based on your body size. So the only other nutrient left to go up and down to adjust to your energy needs is fat. So in the weight loss phase, so if you really have a lot of weight to lose, dietary fat may be lower. But as you transition into weight maintenance and your caloric needs are higher, it's very important that you don't overconsume protein or exceed your carb tolerance. And this is where a lot of people get tripped up.
Well, that's it's a little nebulous to me. You know, so what would be... I'm a sort of normal, I probably weigh like 130, I'm like 5'9". I weigh pretty much what I did in high school thanks to eating this way. And how much protein and how much is there in food? Like, would it be like just that, when they talk about the 4 or 5, or, you know, I probably eat a half pound maybe hamburger or something at lunch because that's all I eat. Where is the too much protein cutoff in terms of like the piles of food?
Yeah, we would recommend between 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of ideal body weight. So if you're, you know, if you're morbidly obese, you know, you wouldn't want to base it on your current weight, because the protein needs are more tied to your lean tissue.
Can you just say that again? What was that one?
It would be about 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of your ideal body weight or your goal weight.
Oh, wait, can you maybe, I'm sorry, I'm not very good at the metric system. Just translate that a little. So what does that translate to in terms of food? If I have, you know, this is actually what
I eat. Well, it would probably on a diet that was reasonable in energy, about 20% of the total calories. So 1/5 of the total calories would be coming from protein.
And carbs, the rest are fat.
Carbs may be as low as 10% or even lower if you're consuming less than 50 grams a day. So this means that fat is upwards of 65 to 70% of calories, especially if you're eating weight maintenance level of energy. So this is why it becomes really important to not fear fat, because if you fear fat, you're going to overconsume protein or overconsume carbs. And that interferes with sort of the fat-burning state that you're promoting by restricting carbs. Because protein can actually stimulate insulin levels, and some of the amino acids can be converted to glucose in the body. So we find in so many cases where people are doing fine restricting carbs, but they're over-consuming protein. So when we have them bring the protein level down a little and increase the fat, that sort of stimulates weight loss, and they feel much better, and their body is switching over to burning fat at a better rate.
Well, another question, you know, another myth actually that bugs me is the idea that the low-carb diet basically gets framed as quote-unquote unhealthy because it isn't quote-unquote balanced, meaning that you aren't eating, you know, 16 different things all day. Well, you know, I know the Inuit ate just whale blubber, and the Maasai aren't eating pasta one night and burritos the next. They just eat cow. So how do you define a balanced diet?
Well, that's very true. This is one of the common criticisms, but you know, it really goes back to how you define balanced, and that's sort of I would call it a cultural bias we have, that you know, we feel like carbs should be the majority of our calories, But as we talked briefly about earlier, from an evolutionary perspective, if you were talking to an Inuit grandmother, what's balanced to them would be very different than what's balanced to the average person. So, when you consider that many people are intolerant to carbohydrate, you know, to say that they should consume 50% of their calories from a nutrient that they don't metabolize very well, that doesn't sound very balanced to me.
And well, here's a question for you. My boyfriend makes fun of me because my favorite foods are steak and green beans, and he'll say, sometimes I've had that for lunch, he'll say, you don't want that for dinner, do you? And I'll say, well, actually, I do. You know, can a person be healthy if they just eat basically steak, green beans, and then bacon and eggs in the morning?
Well, yes. I mean, there are a lot of misconceptions what a low-carb diet is, and even dietitians have this perception that it's a draconian-type diet. But actually, even a very carb-restricted diet has a lot of variety and flexibility. It includes a lot of different vegetables, in particular the non-starchy vegetables, so minus the corn or peas, but it does include a lot of the salad and green leafy vegetables. So you're getting a lot of nutrients there. It includes a lot of different types of meats and cheeses and eggs and high-fat dairy and butter. And so, it's actually quite the opposite. There's just so much creativity you can have with these foods without, the bread and the pastas and the cereals and so forth. And, it's changing your metabolism, so you're not as hungry either. You're not, you can skip a meal because you're not going to be in a fuel crisis. So these are all, adaptations and, sort of the underlying physiology that, and most people describe it as being very empowering, and they're much more satisfied and satiated on this type of diet relative to a higher carb diet.
That's an important thing. I mean, I'm sorry, I cannot complain. Oh, gee, I have to eat 3 strips of greasy bacon every day and a cheese omelet made in a lot of butter. Oh, it's such a hardship.
So it's not a sacrifice as a lot of people perceive it. It's actually very empowering to be in control and not be driven by, these cravings and so forth that a lot of people have with carbohydrates.
Oh, and maybe you'll back me up on this. You said the magic words high-fat dairy, which is the kind that I eat, the brie, that double, triple cream brie.
Yeah.
Can you please tell me if I'm right on this, that it is pretty much child abuse or person abuse to drink skim milk?
Well, I agree. I think it's skim milk, fat-free milk, and I think, the low-fat cheeses are just criminal.
I know. Here we are, this rich society. There are cows. This is California, the land of happy cows. And people are drinking this white water and feeding it to their children. It is just terrible.
Yeah. No, I'm in total agreement.
And I wanted to get back into this thing, and Dr. Eads talks about this. He and Mary Dan Eads, who's also a doctor, wrote this book with his fitness trainer, The Slow Burn Fitness Revolution. And you talked about, I quoted at the beginning, that you say exercise is not a weight loss tool. In fact, when heavy people exercise regularly, horrors, their resting, you didn't say horrors, but their resting metabolism slows by 5 to 15% on average, which is just depressing. But you also talk about, the importance of doing weight work.
Right. Well, yeah, there's quite a bit there, again, to discuss and explain, because on the surface, this is not popular to tell people that exercise is not a good weight loss tool, because that's what we're told. If you're overweight, you should exercise.
We like to believe that fat people are fat because they're lazy. When, you go to the gym and you see the fat person who's on the treadmill for 3 hours.
Right. And that's not the case. It's very much tied to your genetics. And if I can just take a minute to describe a classic experiment that was done in identical twins, an extremely well-controlled study. So these are, identical twins, so they share the same genetics. They had these twins exercise for 2 hours per day, so, very prodigious amount of exercise for 3 months, and they held their calories constant at a level that they would maintain weight if they were sedentary. So the extra energy they were burning during exercise should should contribute to weight loss. So on average, they were burning about 600 kcals per day extra by this 2 hours of exercise for 3 months. And then they measured their weight loss, and it turned out they had, I think it was 8 sets of twins. They should have lost about close to, I think, 16 pounds or so. Only one pair of twins even came close to that. One pair of twins only lost 2 pounds. So can you imagine how frustrated they were working out 2 hours a day and for 3 months and only lost 2 pounds? And other twins lost in, you know, somewhere in between there. The amazing thing was, although there was wide variability between twins in weight loss, the within-twin variability was very tight. So there was a high concordance within twins. So if you were one that lost 2 pounds, your sibling also lost 2 pounds. So this tells us genetics plays a huge role in how you respond to exercise in terms of weight loss. And the explanation of how you could actually have no weight loss by exercising 2 hours a day is that your resting metabolism actually goes down to compensate for that extra energy that's being burned.
And now, speaking of weight loss, you actually talk about in here how a problem, and I recognize this too, with people who say, oh, these low-carb diets don't work, is that people tend to do these just for weight loss, and then they go back to eating carbohydrates, which, number one, seem terrible for your health if you've read Wheat Belly by the cardiologist William Davis. You know, but, you know, this to me is a way of life because I realize I'll be so much more healthy. So how do you convince people who say, oh, no, I'm just going to go on this diet and then I'm going to go back to eating pizza?
Well, that's right. It should be viewed as a lifestyle and something that's going to be sustained. And again, the idea of personalization comes back. I tend to think, you know, most people should start very low just to make sure that they respond well. And then
you let me just stop you. Low carb, so very low carb.
Very low carb, and then add carbs back to the point where you know, their individual tolerance lies. And the fact is, some people will be able to add carbs back and maybe eat pizza, but many people won't. And if they do, they'll regain weight and go into a downward spiral, which is so common. So this is where, you know, the personalization comes in. There's no standard, you know, rule here in how much carbs you can add back. But if you really want to be safe, we refer to this as sort of an island of safety. You know, you err on the side of caution by keeping the carbs low. And for a lot of people, it's a bit like playing with fire as you add carbs back because you don't want to exceed your threshold. But that threshold varies from person to person. It also varies within a person over time. Many people, as they age, they become more insulin resistant and carb tolerant. So you may have been able to tolerate 150, 200 grams of carbs when you were young, but now you may only be able to tolerate 75 grams. So it's something that changes over the lifespan as well.
And now part of this that's a problem is that you're really on your own. And I know more, I think, than the average person about dietary science, you know, but I know that my doctor actually doesn't know too much, and I kind of use her just to get tests. She told me that my cholesterol is high and I'd have to go on a statin if I didn't lower it and I needed to come back for another test. And I just ignore that because I've always had actually very good levels, and I didn't fast before I got my blood test, and I told her that. You know, but, you know, so basically I use it for testing, but what about people who, you know, have a doctor who is, you know, telling them they're going to kill themselves, that they should go back to eating grain afterward to have a quote-unquote balanced diet? How do they respond to that?
Well, it's tough, and that's really one of the main reasons we wrote The Art and Science of Low-Carb Living. It's directed at healthcare professionals, so we would hope that doctors and nurses and dietitians would read this on their own volition, but I suppose it's also the type of book that as a patient you could recommend or even provide to your physician.
That's actually a great idea. And I actually haven't done a station ID. And the truth is that I haven't wanted you to stop talking, but I will. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. I'm talking with Dr. Jeff S. Volek, PhD, wonderful researcher of low carb and related things. His book is The Art and Science of Low Carbohydrate Living. It's really terrific and busts every misconception that everyone has about how low carb is going to kill you, et cetera, et cetera. And just on the doctor level, I found something out reading your book. I know who Jimmy Moore is. He does wonderful, puts out wonderful information from various people on low carb. He has a service to find doctors experienced in the use of low carb. And when I say service, he has a Blogspot blog, and he encourages people to post names of other doctors. And the URL is lowcarbdoctors.blogspot.com. So it's lowcarbdoctors.blogspot.com. And you can find a few doctors listed there. And maybe those doctors would be able to recommend somebody in your city if your city's not listed. So I wanted to just, you know, cut a few more of these myths out, use you to do that. And another one, oh, this is really important. Your scale is not your friend. Your bathroom scale when you're losing weight. Explain that.
Well, it's not your friend because it can be deceptive because of mainly shifts in body fluid. The average person can vary plus or minus 4 pounds on the scale just due to normal variation in water loss. And so depending on where you're at in that range of up or down 4 pounds, that can be very deceiving as far as true weight loss. So we really recommend that people not obsess about measurement of the scale day to day, but you know, we say, for example, you can do a rolling average, or you measure 3 days in a row, take an average, and then, you know, if you're really into graphing your weight and monitoring it, look at those types of trends over time and not be too obsessed with the day-to-day change in the scale, because that's so impacted by changes in body water.
You know, another thing that you write about that's very important that I think we have to put out there, people get all freaked out about their LDL cholesterol or quote-unquote bad cholesterol number. But it turns out doctors don't really measure the right thing. It turns out the size of the particles matters.
Yeah, the cholesterol story turns out to be a lot more to that iceberg. But we still focus a lot on just the number, you know, the LDL cholesterol number. But we have clear evidence now that LDL cholesterol is not a single entity. It's a very heterogeneic set of particles that vary in size. And some people have more small LDL than large LDL. And it's the small LDL that are most atherogenic or most harmful.
So they slip through. Is it that they slip through and cause plaque?
Yeah, they tend to penetrate into the arteries easier. They're more prone to oxidize and cause oxidative stress and inflammation. And they have a longer half-life, so they hang around in the circulation longer. But they're also tied metabolically to other things going on in the body. So if you have high triglycerides, for example, almost surely you'll have this LDL profile that's characterized by a predominance of these small LDL. So they tend to go together metabolically with other markers. So if you have metabolic syndrome, there's a good chance you have the small LDL. But the bottom line is, you know, I think it's the LDL is not the best marker. You know, and it's more about the quality of the LDL than the quantity of the LDL. And other markers are equally, if not more important than just the LDL cholesterol number. So it gets a little tricky, and just relying on LDL as the primary marker, I think, is now being reexamined on many levels.
And last, I wanted to deal with actually diabetes, because people who have type 2 diabetes, which is the one, not the one you get from birth, but that comes from insulin resistance, they basically feel like it's just a sentence and they're stuck. But actually, you write about how, you know, restricting carbs can basically put diabetes into remission.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the low-hanging fruit for, you know, for low-carb diets as far as their therapeutic benefit. And I really hesitate to ever embellish things too much, but a well-formulated low-carb diet is literally a proverbial silver bullet for someone with type 2 diabetes. And I, you know, I have personal friends and colleagues who, in one case, we talk about him in the book, so I don't mind mentioning him as a physician in Canada who discovered he had type 2 diabetes.
Was it Jay Burns?
Jay Wortman.
Jay Wortman, right.
I believe 10 years ago now, and on his own volition decided that restricting carbohydrates made the most sense. And, you know, he's basically put his disease into complete remission. But he's highly, highly insulin resistant and has to keep his carbohydrates under 40 grams per day. So he hasn't cured type 2 diabetes in the traditional sense, but as long as he keeps his carbs below 40 grams, he has no evidence of diabetes. All his markers are completely normal, so he can manage the disease and have no outward symptoms or signs of diabetes as long as he keeps it below 40.
It's just remarkable. Now, we're out of time, but I wanted to ask you for one last takeaway. Let me just say who I'm talking to first. I've been speaking with Dr. Jeff S. Bollock, PhD. He's a dietary researcher, and his book, co-authored with Stephen D. Finney, MD, PhD, is The Art and Science of Low-Carbohydrate Living. I recommend it. The subtitle is An Expert Guide to Making the Life-Saving Benefits of Carbohydrate Restriction Sustainable and Enjoyable. And I want to just ask you for one final takeaway. If you could tell a person that you're passing in the street one thing about diet and dietary science and being healthy, what would it be?
Well, I would say, you know, we promote a single dietary message in this country to a population with vastly different capabilities of positively responding to that message. So what that means is we really need to move toward personalization of diet and embracing alternative approaches outside of the, you know, the traditional low-fat diets. And the reality is many of us are hardwired to respond favorably to a well-formulated low-carbohydrate diet. It really makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, and the latest science has really been remarkable in showing positive effects.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jeff Bullock, for being with me today. Again, the book is The Art and Science of Low-Carbohydrate Living. This was a nerd's dream, this show with you. I hope everyone buys this book because it's truly fantastic, and it really does just crush every myth anybody's ever had about what they should eat.
Well, thank you so much, Amy. It's been a pleasure. I wish we had another hour.
Me too.
Don't wait. Get this limited-time holiday offer only from Fios. Click the banner to get incredibly fast 150 meg internet.